This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 22nd of May on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Ahead over the next hour, we hop from London to Stockholm, from Paris to Berlin, and across the Atlantic to New York, where the annual Design Week has just come to a close. Coming up, we take a trip up the orbit, London's controversial 100-metre-high Olympic Park sculpture.
The Olympics is showing Britain to the world, and this is saying that there is a certain spirit of invention in this country which allows for, let's say, the modern, the new.
We hear how British designer Sir Paul Smith has a habit of hoarding rabbits.
I've got glass rabbits, pottery rabbits, papier-mâché rabbits. I even had a minute before my fashion show started a few years ago, a lady arrived with a real rabbit in a box.
Aww.
So it's true, there are a lot of rabbits everywhere.
And we sit down with German architect Felix Burichter to talk about his brilliant architecture magazine, Pinup.
There's so much here to write about. Usually it's easier to kind of say, oh, you know, we're going to edit this out, or we're going to do this later. But you can't, when you do a city-specific issue, you kind of really want to pack everything in that you sort of experienced during your stay.
We also talk to the off-schedule mavens of New York's Design Week, drop in on a retail institution in the heart of Stockholm, and we visit an up-and-coming area on the banks of the Seine in Paris too. All that to come on this week's episode of Section D, here on Monocle 24. In 2009, the Mayor of London announced a design competition for a sculpture that would be the focal point of the Olympic Park. The brief was simple. It must be a tower of at least 100 metres. Out of 50 submissions, it was Indian-born British sculptor Anish Kapoor and his collaborator Cecil Balmond who received the honour. The orbit was previewed to the international media last week, but the jury's still out on whether this is the 21st century landmark London has been longing for. Monocle's Adrian Craddock was in attendance, and here's what he found.
All metal things, loose change, mobile phones, and here it is. Thank you.
I've just finished getting through security to take a peek at one of the most highly anticipated pieces of British public art of the last decade. The Excelemittal Orbit was designed by Anish Kapoor and Cecil Balmond. It's a 100-metre-tall tower of winding red steel, stairs and viewing platforms. Nestled next to the Olympic Stadium, the structure will be one of the first things visitors see when they come through the gates of the Olympic Park in East London. At the top of the tower, sandwiched between the concave mirrors that line the rounded walls and a scrum of international media, the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, sung the sculpture's praise.
It's a statement of economic confidence in London, in the Stratford site. It's our way of saying that London is welcoming the world, it's beckoning the world to London in 2012 for the summer. But it's also, even more important, it's a great work of art, but it is there to serve as a pole of attraction, something that people are going to want to bring their kids up to look around, to enjoy for a long time to come. And that is all part of our strategy to make sure that the Olympics deliver long-term benefits for this part of London. There's no point in putting £9.3 billion into the Olympic Games if people don't keep coming, don't keep finding a reason to want to come and visit this site. So that was why we needed to do it.
Anish Kapoor's work has appeared in cities from Chicago to Naples. He's famous for challenging preconceptions of space and scale with his impressive installations. Anish told me he hopes the building sends a strong message to the world about Britain's spirit of invention.
The Olympics is showing Britain to the world, and this is saying that there is a certain spirit of invention in this country which allows for, let's say, the modern, the new. And I hope what we've managed to do is to do something modern and new. Mm-hmm. Orbit is an asymmetrical form that really needs taking part in. It's also a series of experiences. You know, as you enter it, you have one kind of experience, then you come up, and it's a completely different kind of experiences in of it in this room with these mirrors and looking out over London. So there are things happening here that are about engaging in and taking part.
And you described the structure earlier as awkward. What did you mean by that?
Well, because it's a deconstructed tower and a non-symmetrical form, it has the status of something that's sort of in process, something that's becoming. And that requires you as a viewer to look at it from many, many different points of view, because as an image it won't allow a single form. And that has kind of awkwardnesses in it.
Kapoor's collaborator, Cecil Belmond, who is often described as one of the most important forces in contemporary architecture, says he is still surprised by the structure.
If you have a tower that just goes up and you have a viewing platform, that's not a surprise. I mean, you come up and you look and you go back down. Here, the experience is at many levels. When you enter, we put a canopy in so you can't look up. And when you get to the top here, there's a hole to look back down, and there are mirrors that brings the sky back into you. And then the form itself is coiling its way around you so that it's never the same. And today, walking, I looked up and I see it in a new way again, because the way space has been seen conventionally, you just go up in a straight line, you come back down. Here, literally, it is an orbit within an orbit several times over. So that sense of space being turned around you changes your perception.
What do you hope the legacy to London is of this structure?
I think a vibrant centre, attraction centre, people come visit. And more importantly than the attraction, I trust, begin to get a new feeling about how spaces can get made. And it evolves their own sense of what they assumed was possible.
Despite the fanfare surrounding the unveiling, the tower hasn't been well received by everyone. One journalist from The Times described the orbit as being like an enormous wire mesh fence that's gotten hopelessly snagged around the bell of a giant French horn. For a niche, the criticism is expected.
I think when there's a new addition at this scale to London skyline, people will question it, and it's right they should. And some of the observations will be critical, and that's the way it should be.
Cecil Belmond has a similar philosophy.
Anything on the London skyline, new and big and bold, will attract comment. And most of the comment I find is the right sort of proportion. About three-quarters of the people like it, about a quarter don't. But people will read into it what they want, like any new piece, you know. So that doesn't worry me, and I think that's part of doing something bold.
What Anish Kapoor does take exception to is the £15 admission charge that people will have to pay to visit the orbit. He says he's disappointed the structure isn't available to everyone.
Oh, I wanted to do something that's, you know, fully democratic, which is what this work aspires to. Now, £15 is expensive. So we will work hard to try and get the price reduced or taken away completely when it comes into legacy mode.
For now, though, those who can't afford the entry can make do with the orbit's wacky exterior, which can be seen from throughout East London. As for whether its roller coaster come helter-skelter form will become an icon of the area, only time will tell.
That was Monocle's Adrian Craddock at the orbit in London's Olympic Park. Time to hop across the Atlantic now. And with the annual Design Week coming to a close in New York, we headed to an exciting newcomer on the scene. Wanted Design was founded by Odile Hanot and Claire Pijula in response to what the pair saw as a growing stagnation in the city's Design Week. Hanot and Pijula felt that the festival had too tight a focus on buyers and industry insiders, with hardly anything for the general public to engage with. The duo launched Wanted last year with a series of exhibitions, installations and special presentations, and it proved to be a tremendous success. This year was bigger and better, cementing the event firmly on the city's design schedule. Monocle's Barrett Austin caught up with Hanot and Pijula in Manhattan.
We started, actually, we met with Claire a year and a half ago, and we had the same feeling that something was missing in New York. And every year in New York, during the Design Week in May, everyone is looking for more than the Javits Center and a few, you know, event in the city. And when we met, it was right away the great match to combine our expertise and our desire to create a biggest event, a satellite event, but in one place regroup independent designers, established brands, institution, design schools, all together in one place and in a New York way, so to create something very special to New York.
And for those who aren't familiar with Wanted Design, tell us a little bit about what it is. What's featured here? Tell us about some of the programming.
It's more than just presenting or introducing a new product. Really, the idea of Wanted Design is to be a platform for people to come all together and connect. So it's about telling the story of the brands, of the manufacturers, of the materials, the process, the making of, the cultural background. We don't just show product, but we also tell the story of the product. So it means also that it's very interactive. We have a rich program. We have every day, it's nonstop. Actually, people can come and spend all 3 days here because we have conversation series, we have workshops, we have special presentation. This year, we have also a neon workshop. We have a student's workshops. We have, this year, it's a new program. We have 6 fantastic design schools that are going to be there with 22 students working all together on a project. So it's very about collaboration.
The main thing that was really important to us was the experience I wanted design. So it's welcoming people in a very special environment, having good coffee, good tea, you know, good people to meet, and really building the experience around, as Odile said, the products and going beyond that. And I think that's the main difference between Wanted Design and a regular trade show is that we bring more and we push people to, you know, go beyond their limits. And they really appreciate that and they're all really good at that, actually.
How does this year's event differ from last year's?
The main difference is the size of the event. It's 3 times bigger than last year. That means more people involved, more brands, more design schools. The workshop is bigger. The conversation series is, you know, richer. And everything is improved from last year. And it's also building this event since last year when the first edition was really put together in a few months. So this edition is really more what Wanted Design is supposed to be and how it's going to be in the next, you know, years in the future.
It looks like it was very wanted. So last year when people arrived, they discovered it and then they said, okay, yeah, that's something we wanted to have in New York. So since last year we are working on this edition and we are working for 2013. And above Wanted Design, we really engaged a dialogue, a conversation with all the group in New York that are doing events during the Design Week, and we are trying to be stronger all together, like the NoHo Design District, the Model Citizen, American Design Club, the Cooper Hewitt Museum. I mean, everyone, I mean, we have met all together for months in trying to see, okay, how we should work together to promote together what we do, to bring more people in the city and to build all together something special in New York.
How would you describe the state of the design scene here in New York at the moment?
It's definitely booming. Like we can feel, and not just New York, I would say American design. It's really interesting to see more and more American designers going to Europe, working with European manufacturers, but also European getting interested in American design. You start seeing this in magazines and hearing about it. So we're really happy to be in this moment where we feel that it's kind of bubbling and we, you know, we're ready to host this type of events because there is a lot of interesting things to do and to see in American design, and that's what we really want to do too. It's focus on the Americas, show more of what's happening here in New York, but in the rest of the U.S., in North America, South America.
And how does Design Week here in New York differ from cities like Stockholm or Milan or Paris?
Well, that's really interesting question because everybody's wondering why New York is not at the level of the other cities. So New York Design Week is not really a week. It's only a few days now. But it's growing and is willing to do anything to reach the level of the European cities. But what's really important, I guess, and we talked a lot about this with the other people that we're working on this with, is that it has to be New York. We can't duplicate whatever London or Stockholm are doing. The cultural background is different. You know, everything from a cultural or geographic or even strategic point of view is different. So it has to be New York, so it has to be built by New Yorkers and people that are here really interested in design, pushing design for what it is here in the Americas, and make New York very special with its own identity. The potential is there, and that's where we really wanna be in a few years.
I think this year we have more than a half of the program that is from what's happening in the USA. And I think a month after Milano, if we want people, international visitors, to come in New York, they have to see something that is special to the USA and North America and South America. We have this huge exhibition from Brazil, and we hope to bring more next year from South America, because South America, I mean, there should be much more visible here in New York. So we are working on that, and we really hope to have them next year here at Wanted Design.
And looking at this year's fair, what are the two of you most excited about?
The program here that's going to happen in the VIP lounge is really exciting. It's very, very rich this year. We have a lot of speakers that we're really thanking because they're doing a great job to participating. So the conversation series program is interesting. It's also because this is planned, but you never know how it's going to be, because it's about people interacting with each other.
We are very passionate. I guess that's why we are able to do it. And the challenge is to... New York is a very expensive city, so it's to be able to do something starting from zero and be able to convince everyone that they have to follow us, that we are trying to keep, you know, the cost at the minimum, but it has a cost. So the challenge is to do beautiful things with not a lot of resource.
That was Monocle's Barrett Austin with Odile Hanot and Claire Pijula, founders of Wanted at New York Design Week. Time for a short break now, but stay tuned. We'll be finding out about Paul Smith's habit of collecting after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Fashion designer Paul Smith has a passion for collecting, which has inspired not just his own work, but amassed a legion of fans too, who hoover up his curious objects. As we continue our series on hoarders and collectors, our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer met with Paul Smith in the living museum that is his office to find out more about his collection of books, robots, toys, and rabbits.
One of the things I've done right since the beginning of my career is just been lucky enough to be blessed with good observation. And, I always promote the idea that you can find inspiration in anything, and if you can't, please look again. And my father wasn't a designer or a creative person, but he had this amazing ability to just see things and observe things and would seem to see things that other people didn't see. And I hope that I've managed to get a bit of that from him. And so with all the various crazy things that I seem to be interested in, and that the room where we're sitting is just full of books, robots, toys, bicycles, origami, paintings, everything. And so absolutely, of course, you can get inspiration from any of those things. But you can get inspiration from walking down the street, graffiti on a wall, the shape of a postman's mail bag, or, you know, the feeling of a rough wall against a smooth wall can be Harris tweed against silk. So, you know, if you train your eyes to look and see, then you can get your ideas from anything.
So where do you like scavenging best?
I mean, I travel the world for about 8 months of the year, and so I know most of these sort of important street markets from around the world. So if I'm in Lucca in Tuscany, or if I'm in New York, or if I'm in LA, and then also in addition to the markets, I know I have a furniture shop in Mayfair, which sells lots of interesting furniture. So I'm quite in touch with a lot of dealers as well. And although I don't personally do the buying anymore like I did at the beginning because I'm too busy, there's this sort of this wealth of places around the world that I know about. And then, of course, a lot of people have realised that I like things, so I get sent a lot of things all the time. The post bag, most days, is pretty exciting, you know. They're not precious things particularly, but they're just an old magazine, a book, cycling magazine, for instance. I get a lot of cycling magazines, but I've got a young fan from Belgium who sends me things that she makes all the time. I've got a Japanese fan who sends origami. I've got another Japanese fan who hand-carves things and sends them to me, like a hand-carved camera or object or something. I did a talk recently somewhere, and at the end of the talk, somebody said to me about being a collector. And I said, rather stupidly, I said, no, I'm not a collector, but I do have a large quantity of the same thing. And then I said, actually, that's collecting, isn't it? But what I meant by that was that a lot of collectors are like geeks, because I have a lot of watches in the cabinet where you're sitting, but behind where you're sitting, but I don't know anything about them. I couldn't tell you anything about them. I bought them just because... again, back to the word spontaneity, I bought them just because I like them. So what I meant by that silly comment was that, yes, I have lots of robots, and I have lots of books, and I have lots of toys, and I have watches and all sorts of things, but I don't know anything about them. I just buy them purely based on the fact that they do something to me, and if I can afford them, I buy them.
I've seen a lot of rabbits around.
Yeah, they do breed, you know, rabbits. So in 1982, I was on a train going to Nottingham from London, my hometown, and I was with an American friend, and I was daydreaming looking out of the window. And he said to me, what are you looking so intently at? And I just said, completely untrue, I just said, I'm looking for rabbits, because if I see a rabbit, my next collection will sell really well. And he stayed for a few days, went back to New York, and then he sent me this paper mache rabbit, which he bought, I think it was from Tiffany's actually, so it's quite posh. And then he must have told somebody who told somebody who told somebody. So I now get between 6 and 20 rabbits of some sort a week, and I have 80 boxes of rabbits in my warehouse in Nottingham. So I've got glass rabbits, pottery rabbits, papier-mâché rabbits. I even had a minute before my fashion show started a few years ago, a lady arrived with a real rabbit in a box.
Aww.
So yes, it's true, there are a lot of rabbits everywhere.
So you're an accidental collector of rabbits.
Yeah.
So what kind of things give you a thrill in finding them?
Because I'm so instinctive and so compulsive, I just say, I like that, and it's not based on anything. But, of course, what you really get excited about is if you find something like an old piece of wallpaper or a piece of an old apron that's got some printing on it or something, or anything, where you just think, wow, that can really spark off something in my mind that will turn into an idea for, you know, some of my work. And there are lots of things that over the years, like when I first went to Japan, I started collecting old workwear, work clothes that were sort of 80 years old, 90 years old. And they'd got all the sashiko stitching, you know, all the little hand stitching. There were repairs. So whereas now we would throw something away, or we'd be delighted it had a hole in it. Obviously, in the past, people used to repair things, even socks, as you know, in this country, through darning. And it's called sashiko over there. So I'd buy all this indigo dyed workwear, and then that just became a massive collection for my jeans collection. So it's really exciting if you find things that can then turn into an idea for the interior of a shop, some display for your window of your shop, or clothes.
I mean, your office is this amazing treasure trove of beautiful objects, but how do you find everything?
Oh, well, actually, oddly enough, nearly always I can put my hand on things because, I mean, my design assistants are on the floor below, and then we have regular, almost daily meetings, all of us. So either I go down to the studio downstairs because that's where all the yarns or the fabrics are. But at the initial, when we're starting new collections, they normally come to me. And I'll often lean back in my chair and I say, I love the colours in this book. And then they go, how did you know where that book was? And I just said, I don't know, but I just did. And so I seem to know where most of the things are. I don't know quite how, but...
Instinct.
Yeah, somehow.
That was Hazel Pfeiffer with Sir Paul Smith in his London office. Time for a song, and this is in honour of Sir Paul. This is The Hoarder by Cock and Bull. That was The Hoarder by Cock and Bull Kid. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. A huge concrete block on the River Seine that once served as a cargo bay at the turn of the 20th century has been transformed by architects Jacob and McFarlane into a hub of design and fashion. Our reporter Saima Tariq talked to Brendan McFarlane about the creation of Les Docks, the French capital's newly reworked megastructure.
On the banks of the Seine close to Gare Austerlitz is a green swoosh of glass and steel bulging from an industrial building that is 280 metres long. It is the defining feature of Les Docks, one of the first reinforced concrete structures in the world, which Jacob and McFarlane architects have transformed into a modern, multi-use space. Brendan McFarlane explains why his Paris-based office, when given the choice of demolishing the 1907 site, decided to maintain it to create the Cité de la Mode et du Design.
We know the building wasn't liked by Parisians when they saw it, and it really was imagined really as a big storeroom for goods coming up the Seine, or down, up and down the Seine. So it was really at that point this extraordinary piece of infrastructure, beginning of the 20th century, but connected with the earlier histories, you know, the horse and cart, etc. So you had this kind of crazy kind of confrontation between 19th and 20th centuries. For us, we were very interested in all of that because we knew that when we came to the site, we were in the same kind of epoch or century-changing period. We knew that Corbusier had written a text on the project. He was very interested in it, and you must keep in mind that this predates projects like the Domino House of 1922. We're talking about 1907. So it really is, it is quite an important prototype for the world because it was infrastructural. It had no face. It had no... in a sense, architectural urban necessity. So it was really like a kind of a carcass, a skeleton. What we saw then was that whatever we did with this project, if we kept it for reasons of historical reasons and also sustainable reasons, because today it seems absurd really to get rid of a gigantic piece of concrete. Where do you put it? It's probably a bit more interesting to keep it and build on it.
Instead of emphasising the modernist aesthetic of the 12,000 square metre building with sheets of glass or cladding, Jacob and McFarlane's penchant for re-architecture led to the creation of a controversially bright green skin, a strange but complex geometric web of glass tubing that houses the public circulation space between all three floors, as well as connecting the space to the River Seine itself.
So what we did was we imagined this thing as something that was clipped onto the building, really like a new visage, a new face, or a face, which in fact there wasn't one before. So it's in a sense like a kind of surgical intervention. And as soon as we did that intervention, we knew that we would have to kind of not just clip, but actually the face would be structured by the building, therefore it's past, but would also become a kind of an emergence. The history of the building was about traversing the building. It was never a building that belonged to its site. It was as though it was parachuted in here. It wasn't liked. It didn't belong. And our job, in a sense, we felt, was to bring it down back into its site and make it belong. And the work of doing that was to try and situate the new piece of architecture in relationship to the river and all of the movement, the circulatory movement of the city. So in analysing all of that, we found that the most interesting movement towards the future of Paris also would be along the river and not at 90 degrees to it. The green is not a green of the river. It's an inspiration from the river. And it's actually two colours that are mixed. It's yellow and green because we want to talk about both the sky and the water. So what we did was we created during the conceptual phase a phantom structure, and then introduced the idea of how to move up and down the building and create all the circulation as a public circulation, like saddlebagging a donkey or a horse, putting it on the outside, on the riverside, and then that gets you up onto the roof, and on top of which then are a series of programs. And that becomes the building vocabulary for the whole project.
The completed building has finally given Paris a cross-collaborative space for fashion and design, all under one roof. The country's most important fashion school, l'Institut de la Mode Française, has been based there since 2008, moving from its closed-off Haussmannian building in the 17th to the transparent and open second floor. New gallery spaces are currently shown the recent collections of Balenciaga and Comme des Garçons, and will also accommodate future exhibitions by young European designers showing off their prototypes to the world. On top of all this, a wood-decked rooftop garden, design stores, clubs, and restaurants will gradually open, as several years of conceptual brainstorming by the mix of clients have finally ended, much to Brendan's relief.
Of course, when you see the image of the building, you know, one takes an immediate position. You know, is it something that really works? Is it something which is a great new addition to Paris, or is it something which is completely new? And it's difficult to change Paris. Not that one wants to change it, but one wants to evolve it into a new city as well. And so the great thing, I think, since 2 weeks is that we've had the public through, and that's been a miracle, because they've been able to walk up and down the spine of the building over the River Seine. They've been able to experience the atmosphere inside the building, but out over the river, and the kind of smells, the quality of light, very strange kind of diaphanous quality with the glass, different diagonal views out over the river, which I think is completely unique in Paris. We've never really had that chance before. Of course, we've moved across the river, and maybe we've stopped occasionally on bridges like the Pont des Arts, and we've wanted to stop. We've wanted to take in those aspects of being out over the river. But that's somehow in a much more classical tradition. And I think for the first time we've been able to get Parisians or get visitors into that condition.
What is it like working on such a big project that's been delayed and put off for years and years? You initially got the contract in 2004, is that right?
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Interesting is a funny word. I mean, in the sense that you go through phases of utter despair and think, oh my God, you know, where is this thing going to ever open, etc. And then you become philosophical, and then you go back into despair and become philosophical. It really hasn't sort of dawned on us just yet that it is open now. It's still, because one's actually almost a wee bit reticent to just jump up and down after 6 years. I think that's natural. I think the greatest thing is just to have people coming up to you and not throw you their arms around you, but actually just say what they're feeling. And I think those words are remarkable. I think they have a great medicinal role.
That was our reporter Saima Tariq in Paris with architect Brendan McFarlane. Time for a quick break, but stay tuned. We're off to Berlin after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. A few years back, German-born architect Felix Burchter saw a niche in the architecture magazine market. Plenty of specialty titles catered to architects, and mainstream shelter magazines appealed to the general market. But Burchter felt there was room for a publication that was both a bit nerdy and fun to read. And so he founded Pinup, a magazine for architectural entertainment. The magazine has recently begun running city-specific issues, moving the editorial staff to a new place for a few months. Pinup's Berlin special hit the newsstands last week, and Monocle's Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley, sat down with Burchter to hear all about it.
I was in Berlin in May 2011, and a few months earlier we had just done an LA issue, and I really liked the experience. I spent about 4 months in Los Angeles and made that issue. And I always thought, oh, you know, wouldn't it be nice to every, and we only come out every 6 months, so wouldn't it be nice every couple issues, to do a city-specific magazine. And I'm from Germany. I'm not from Berlin, but I'm German. And I haven't lived here in 15 years. And I was in Berlin last summer, and I really fell in love with the city. And I said, this is it. This is the next one. This is the next city issue I want to do.
Can you tell me what's in the issue?
Oh, God, a lot. 250 pages. First of all, it's the biggest issue we've done so far. So this is issue 12. It comes out every 6 months. So it's been like 5.5 years now. And this is definitely the thickest issue. And part of the reason is because there's so much here to write about. You know, usually it's easier to kind of say, oh, you know, we're going to edit this out, or we're going to do this later. But you can't, when you do a city-specific issue, you kind of really want to pack everything in that you sort of experienced during your stay, or what you've discovered while you were here. There's a lot of history, or there's a lot of stories that kind of put contemporary Berlin in a historic context, or the other way around, putting historic Berlin in, you know, seeing historic Berlin in a contemporary context. One story that we started very early on is a very typical vase that is made here in Berlin. I know, this is not architecture, this is the design part. There's a vase that's made by a 300-year-old porcelain manufacturer, KPM, Königliche Porzellanmanufaktur. They came out in 1931. Marguerite Friedländer, who used to study at the Bauhaus, she designed a beautiful vase for KPM. It's a design classic. To this day, it's one of the most popular vases from that porcelain manufacturer. And we got 5 New York artists to reimagine or reappropriate that vase in a contemporary way. So it's kind of taking, you know, classic Berlin, contemporary New York, and art, and mixing it with design. So it's, it kind of covers all the bases of what Pinup usually covers in like one concise project. What else is in the issue? Several interviews, big feature interviews with architects and designers. One is David Chipperfield, who is the director of this year's Architecture Biennale. He's especially famous or revered here in Berlin because he spent 12 years of his life renovating the Neues Museum. He did, about 5 or 6 big projects around the city. And now he even got the bid for renovating the Neue Nationalgalerie, kind of the shrine of modernism in the city, so by Mies van der Rohe. Then there's Jürgen Meyer H., a German architect. And then there's Francis Carré, who's from Burkina Faso, but who lives here. And he's fascinating because he came here with almost nothing. I think he came on like a stipend. And then he was working on construction sites, and then he did his high school diploma, and then he started studying architecture, and then went back to his village in Burkina Faso in Africa, in West Africa, and started building a school for his village. It's actually a lot of people who are not necessarily from Berlin, but whose practice is very typical for what's happening in the city. There's an essay on Ludwig Leo, who's a German architect who only built maybe less than a dozen buildings, and they're all in Berlin. Well, I think there's one that's not in Berlin, but the most famous one you can actually see when you drive down the main, the Straße 17 Juni, which is the main sort of east-west axis. It's kind of a water tank. It's pink, and pretty much everyone who's driven down that big street has seen this building and probably wondering what it is. And very few people actually know. Some architecture nerds do, but this guy is really not well known. So somebody suggested to do a story on that, and I looked into it, and it was a fascinating guy who did very little self-promotion, so there's not very much stuff on him. He's still alive, but he donated his archives to the University of the Arts. So we've been in touch with them, and then we found somebody who was willing to write about it. So there's a whole essay on him, and I don't think anything's been published on him in, I think, about over 20 years or so. I mean, it's a bit of an archy nerdy scoop. So that's kind of how a lot of these stories came together.
What makes Berlin different architecturally from other cities? You mentioned before that there are many layers of history that you may not discover on first or even second look. How did you feel producing this issue, and what did you discover?
Every street corner in Berlin, you scratch the surface a little bit and you get sort of a compacted history of the, you know, everything that crazy that went down in Europe in the 20th century and the world, really, you know, between communism, fascism, anarchy, post-war, modernism. I mean, really, everything you can possibly imagine. It's sort of happened in a concentrated way here in Berlin. That's really fascinating, and how that also translates into the contemporary city, this history. Because there used to be, I think, about 5 million people living in the city before the war, and now there's about 3 or 3.5. So there's space for 1.5 million people that, you know, isn't being used. So first of all, there's that, and then you still have a lot of empty space from, you know, when there was the wall up. You know, there's a lot of ground for, still a lot of ground for experimentation. So even though maybe compared to how much free space there isn't that much architectural production. There is, but, you know, there could be a lot more, but it's just lacking a little bit of money. It's not a very rich city, but just in terms of, I think, intellectually, it's a very rich city in architectural terms. You know, a lot of new ways of approaching architecture, not just from an investor's point of view, because, you know, that's what happens in most other cities, but, you know, just as from a very grassroots approach to architecture. And that mixed in with all the other components that you're used to from other capitals around the world, big investor developer money or projects funded by the state. So there's an incredible wealth of different projects that are happening. And I think that's what makes the city exciting.
That was Monocle's Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley with pin-up editor and architect Felix Burichter. And from Berlin, it's time to head north to Stockholm, where I recently sat down with Michael Asplund, owner of the eponymous design store there. Asplund is more than just a shop selling local Scandinavian design. Michael also manufactures a range of furniture and rugs, supporting young designers and local producers in Sweden. Here he is in his showroom to tell us about the genesis and evolution of Asplund.
My name is Michael Asplund, and I'm the founder of Asplund. And we started in 1990. As a small furniture gallery, and showed furniture as art objects in a numbered edition with the Jonas Bolin and Thomas Sandell.
And at the beginning, it was the Swedish tradition of sort of cabinet making and sort of traditional furniture pieces. Is that right?
Yeah. Very much influenced by Scandinavian design, and so it was in that tradition. We mixed different materials and worked with metalware, glassware, and wood, of course. So.
And working with Swedish designers and producing furniture pieces and rugs, the rugs are produced in India, but the furniture is all made in Sweden still. Do you feel that Asplund is a very Swedish brand?
Yes, it feels very Swedish. We are producing it in Småland, in the far south of Sweden. And when it comes to the furniture collection, we work only with Swedish designers. Except now, this year, we took in some Norwegian designers as well. But when it comes to the rug collection, we work with very well-known international designers to bring more feeling to the thing, so it won't be that Scandinavian. So.
And looking around the shop today, there's a huge range of things. It's furniture, but also many accessories for the home as well, smaller pieces, and not all from Sweden. Some from sort of Denmark, Finland, Norway, and also some from Japan and further afield. When did you make the decision to expand and start selling things made by other people as well?
Yeah, we would like to add more international things to our collection, so the whole concept will be more interesting. Most of the things come from Danish companies and Italian brands, and also from UK.
And do you see the shop as a promotion of a certain type of lifestyle?
Yeah, we will have a Swedish contemporary lifestyle, but it's very much based on the traditional design as well. Yes, you can see, for instance, a table by Thomas Eriksson called Bermuda, which is new, and we mix it with a wishbone chair. This is a very nice mixture between modern and contemporary, and we will also look forward to find new designers and to continue working in this field of mixing new and old.
And is the physical retail space in today's world, where more and more people are shopping for things online, on the internet, what is the benefit of having a physical showroom, do you think?
Mm-hmm. It's like coming into our home, like our open space. It's they are welcome to come here, sit down in a sofa, get an espresso, and feeling that they are a part of this home. I think that's make the concept so much more friendly and familiar.
And do you think that Swedish people living in Stockholm, they are very interested in contemporary design as well as design from sort of the past as well?
Yeah, I think they are very much interested in contemporary design, and the few items that have icon status they are very much interested in, like the Danish elderly furniture, like the Wisborne stone, and Arne Jacobson's lightnings, for instance.
And 10 years from now, where do you see Asplund, the shop? Is it still here, still supporting young designers as well as classic pieces as well, or is the whole thing online?
Yeah, I think we definitely are online, but this is the base for meeting people, new young designers are coming into our space and talking and showing the pieces for us. So I think it's very valuable to have this shop.
And maybe finally, what is it, do you think, about Scandinavian and Swedish design that really people are so inspired by?
I think it's the clean lines, the simplicity, creates a calm, unstressful environment. And you can mix it with elderly things, you can mix it with Italian things, you can mix it with Afro-sculpture, you name it. It's easy to have as a base in your home.
That was me with Michael Asplund, owner of Asplund Design Store in Stockholm. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. We'll be back next week with a celebration of design agency Pentagram's 40th anniversary, a report on a historic Italian pen maker, and a studio visit with master apron maker Matt Dick in San Francisco. So be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Staying in Sweden, here to play us out is Feather by Little Dragon. Thank you for listening.